You are listening to Upside Down Trodden, turning power inside out. Never sounded so good. I am Scott Mullen, and with me, as always, is Sean Namini. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
This is my Marilyn Monroe. Happy birthday, Mr. Co-founder of Upside Down Trodden. Happy birthday, my friend. Congratulations on another year spent in this bitch-ass, fucked-up civilization.
We're still here.
Tell me and the listener, what are you doing to celebrate?
Well, let's see. I scrubbed some moss off the roof today, and
pathetic.
I was going to go to jiu-jitsu, but when I was breaking the dogs before going to jiu-jitsu, they just kind of like gave me this look, like, "Hey, it's getting on in autumn, and the weather right now on your birthday in Portland is 83 degrees and sunny,
just for you, Scott.
So yeah, you can go inside and roll on the mat.
You're a freak,
but you can do that anytime when it's raining. How about you take us to the park?" And I did. And it was fantastic. So I had a great time with them. Came home, hung out with the wifey for a bit. She cooked some fantastic German chocolate cake cupcakes. My favorite type of cake, by the way.
Sounds delicious.
Snacked on those. So it actually was okay. It was actually very productive. I got a lot of stuff done. It was just a working day just like any other day.
I would expect no less of you.
That's my check-in. It's my birthday. So what did you get me, Sean?
I am doing a podcast episode with you, and happy birthday.
I want to say thank you for doing this to me. Can I get you anything? Ice cream, best friend medal, anything? Mm-mm.
And listener doesn't know it, but it's pretty, pretty late at night when we're recording this one. And you're doing that for me, and I really appreciate it. That's my gift, Sean was willing to stay up late and give you quality goods. But honestly, if the show sucks, it's because it's late and we're both tired. Okay!
All natural and technological processes proceed in such a way the availability of the remaining energy decreases. In all energy exchanges, if no energy enters or leaves an isolated system, the entropy of our system increases. Energy continuously flows from being concentrated to becoming dispersed, spread out, and wasted, and useless. New energy cannot be created, and high-grade energy is being destroyed. An economy based on endless growth is unsustainable.
Okay, UpsideDownTron.com. That's the website. Go there, check it out. info@UpsideDownTron.com is the email. Follow us on Twitter @SeanNamini and @ScottWMullen. Now, when you're on the site, go ahead, post up on the forums. Check out the blog. We appreciate that. And go to the gear page, right? If you do it right now, we've got an offer that I guarantee won't last because Sean's not going to let me keep this offer up. During the checkout process, enter promo code Equinox. That's right, Equinox. It's the smart, and if you can't spell, you should be able to spell that, listener. I mean, you're savvy, but EQUINOX, okay. It's the smallest day of the year, and that's why we're giving to you, listener, the biggest deal of the year. For a limited time only, all shirts are 50% off. There, I said it. Half off every one of our shirts. Everyone. Don't let the sun set on this offer. Sun, rise to the occasion. Know when opportunity equinox on your door and get this first ever amazing deal today. Also, we're on iTunes. Hit the subscribe button. We'll come to you twice a month. You're welcome for that. And if you prefer using the United States Postal Service, of course, the home office, Upside Down Trodden, 818 Southwest 3rd Avenue, number 292, Portland, Oregon, 97204.
You'll get nothing and like it.
If you love what you're hearing and you love what we're about and you love what we're trying to do with your help, here's another way you can help, right? Where do they go? Patreon.com. /UpsideDownTrodden, and they can check out our page and learn how they can become official Upside Down Trodden Patreon patrons.
Or they can follow the link from our website, from the footer.
Ooh!
I love it!
And before we get rolling, you know we've always got to have a little guest just with the Charity Cause Endeavor. And Sean, thank you so much for sharing one with me this week. League of Conservation Voters, right? You can find out all about them at lcv.org. The LCV, or League of Conservation Voters, works to turn environmental values into national, state, and local priorities. LCV, in collaboration with state LCV partners, advocates for sound environmental laws and policies, holds elected officials accountable for their votes and actions. So that's a little bit about them. That's what they do. They're fantastic, and they're all around the place, well-funded, well-supported. and you can be a part of the action there. Go check them out, figure out how you can donate support, and find an LCV action in your local neck of the woods. I also want to give you another shout out for something, again, to think about ways to resist. Hint, hint.
It's not even two for Tuesday.
It's Dr. Bronner's. And I don't know if you know who Dr. Bronner's is, but go to drbronner.com and check them out. They are a family business committed to honoring the vision of founder Dr. E.H. Bronner by making socially and environmentally responsible products of the highest quality and by dedicating all their profits to help make ours a better world. A little bit more about Dr. Bronner's. As someone that uses their soap, love them, think they're fantastic. And by the way, this is a soap you can use and wash your hands with. You can also brush your teeth with it. You can also bathe your children in it. It's pretty fantastic. It's pretty amazing. And it's made responsibly with responsible shit, what have you. But this gets into, we've made reference to, what we want to talk about tonight. These great institutions and great companies and great people working very hard to resist, hint, hint, wink, wink, a very awful, awful civilization that even now on my 42nd birthday, Sean, that we still have to live in.
Yeah, and why are we doing a show about resistance? It's because this word can mean many things to many people. And the dictionary is actually helpful on this topic.
Oh, nice.
Defining resistance as the refusal to accept or comply with something, the attempt to prevent something by action or argument, and the ability not to be affected by something, especially adversely. So on a personal level, it can mean resisting certain urges or avoiding pressure from peers or bosses, and this is certainly important.
Resisting that second cupcake tonight for my birthday?
That's right. And it's necessary, but on a global level, resistance is much more of a dire need. Scott and I are not shy about our feelings about the global destruction at the hands of humans that occurs every day, and we certainly have our plans and ideas about how to resist. But what about for you, listener? Are you resisting acknowledgement of the real state of the world? If so, perhaps resistance is part of the problem. Begin with accepting that the state of the civilization is what it is. Now that that's out of the way, ask yourself the following questions. How will you resist the destruction? How will you avoid being adversely impacted by the utter shittiness of our civilization? How will your actions show that you refuse to accept or be complicit in the destruction? How will you attempt to prevent the destruction by your actions or arguments? Don't know where to start? Well, there are lots of ways to resist, and all are welcome. Fear not. We are here for you.
Yeah, we are.
I wanted to throw a little bit of a curveball. I know you don't like curveballs, but resistance in not the same sense as we tend to think of it. So Bruce Lee expanded on this Taoist idea about water in this quote.
Empty your mind. Be formless, shapeless, like water. Now, you put water into a cup. It becomes the cup. You put water into a bottle, it becomes the bottle. You put it in a teapot, it becomes the teapot. Now, water can flow or it can crash. Be water, my friend.
Another way to look at it is with the quote, water is fluid, soft, and yielding, but water will wear away rock, which is rigid and cannot yield. As a rule, whatever is fluid, soft, and yielding will overcome whatever is rigid and hard. This is another paradox. What is soft is strong. So I wanted to ease into this, and your fears about resisting, listener, you don't have to get out there and fight the hard fight right away if you're a little uneasy about it. But fighting and resisting is the important thing. So I wanted to talk to you, Scott, about how water deals with hard and difficult things, and maybe we can accomplish some of the same goals with an approach that is less strenuous than people may want to get into.
Yeah, what do you got?
Well, so water stays true to its flowing nature while still wearing away at the hardest substances on the planet. And it can give life, but when it's channeled and flowing, it can destroy anything in its path. You know, like when Desmond Tutu's saying, you know, what's the ocean but millions of little raindrops? And a bunch of little raindrops, it's not going to hurt me, not going to hurt you. But if a billion raindrops all come into a valley, they'll take out a whole village in a flash flood. So water, this dual nature of water, maybe has a little bit of something for everyone when it comes to resistance. It can seem unyielding. When it comes to resistance, it can just flow around it and get its purpose done. I'm just going to go around you. I'm not going to resist you. I'm just going to go around you and accomplish my task of giving life. Or it can flow together and destroy something in this confluence.
let's stick with the martial arts analogy for a second. You know, you're talking about Bruce Lee. Before I was doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and kickboxing, you know, when I was younger, I did Kosho Shoeru Kempo.
It's a mouthful.
And Hanchi Bruschuknik, my instructor, used to talk about the styles of fighting. So water was one, but one. And they based it off of elements. So you had fire, you had earth, you had... And there's the music, and I mean, we love them. Aren't they great? And I think they're still touring. Are they on their last final tour? Okay, all right, I get it. Earth, wind, fire. Okay, so we had earth, we had wind, you know, air, right? We had fire, air. We had tree, and we had metal. And the idea is, together, all these elements, you know, make up or represent life. And you would be able to flow from one to the other depending on what you're resisting or fighting. So if you think about, you know, we had a buddy way back in the day, great guy, Mike Edwards, right? Huge, huge dude. Like almost went pro, like a couple. Was he on the practice squad for the Redskins and the Falcons? And yeah, big guy. Gentle giant. Huge guy, right? He's Earth. And that's his default setting. Not that he couldn't fight in these different styles. But he's Earth. So what does Earth do? Earth stops water, right? Earth can dam up water.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to come at Mike with a water style. That might be challenging. What do you want to do with Mike, in theory, is? Well, what towers over Earth? Tree. So you fight him like a tree. On the outside, you keep your range. You keep your distance, in as much as you'd be able to, because, you know, he's huge. But, and then so, okay, great. So tree's really good. Yeah, until fire shows up. Quick, fast, on the inside, moves unpredictably. That's hard for tree if you bridge that distance, and so on and so forth. You know, but then, okay, fire's really quick, but then water comes in, and that's more of a jiu-jitsu-y thing, smothering, right? Grappling, down to the ground to contain. Well, if I can get a hold of your fast arms and get you down to the ground...
Put that fire out.
I could put that fire out.
I put the fires out.
I think that that's a good metaphor for resistance because, you know, everybody's different. You know, you probably naturally sort of fall into one of those categories, but you have multiple qualities. It's like they say your rising sign is Aquarius and your, you know, your descending sign is a Scorpio. And it's like, all right, yeah, whatever. Okay, I get it. Just, here's your $2. Leave me alone. But I think that people have sort of a default setting and then they have these other, you know, elements to who they are. And then you would use that. So if you happen to be someone, now let's keep going the matter. That's very, you know, like direct, someone that's very vocal, someone that's very aggressive, somebody that's very, you know, you may be naturally suited to a certain style of resistance and you may find something, an issue that really speaks to you and then you may take your style and approach and tactics and go after that particular issue in that way. You know, I really don't want... genetically modified organisms in my food. I don't want to feed my kids those. Okay.
That's your issue.
Right. You know, I don't like that issue. That's a big issue for me, but maybe that's a big issue for somebody else. Maybe that's a big issue.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like to the listener, this is your, whatever your issue is that you
or issues are, right? They can have more than one, right? But if you tried to do everything, cause there's infinite issues out there. There's so many problems, right?
And we're already doing that. So.
then we're not going to get anywhere, you know, because it's just too much. So we have to focus on, you know, our top stuff and like probably would do ourselves a service and everybody else if we really just focused on one main issue and maybe a couple of supporting issues, but like one main issue and then talking about how to approach it and talking about how to, you know, resist it, to fight it, to challenge it, to dismantle it, to get it to something that is an entity, an institution, a mechanism, a technique, or whatever you want to call it, that is actually democratic and supportive and reciprocal and sustainable and not one that is oppressive and abusive and destructive. So, you know, either it has the capacity to be great, it just needs to be redirected, or if it doesn't, it needs to be dismantled and then, you know, scrap the parts, create something else.
So different tactics for different settings and for different people. And so, you know, like maybe sometimes it's best just to flow around something like water, but you know, we talk about movies a lot and this is about resistance and the phrase resistance is futile came from in modern history anyway, the Borg in Star Trek.
Love who, talking about Star Trek and the Borg, yes.
Who have come to assimilate you into their collective.
Resistance is futile.
And if that's the case, then if you're going against an oppressive regime that has the mentality resistance is futile, you will be either absorbed into the collective or destroyed, then there's no time for flowing, right? There's no time to flow around that. That's when you need different tactics.
Well, but okay, this is why this is such an interesting topic and interesting show, right, listener? Is that if you remember First Contact, circa 1996, great Star Trek film. I think it was the second film that the Next Generation did.
Mm-hmm.
Data, I remember they were the Borg was trying to hack into Data, and he's like, "I don't know why you keep probing me and do you know so on and so forth. I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to all these different little things, right? Like it's just like trying to convince the Borg that it was futile for them to try to assimilate him because he's a robot and it's not going to matter. And his loyalties lie with, you know, Picard and the crew. You're an imperfect being created by an imperfect being. Finding your weakness is only a matter of time." And they believe that they did. And then, of course, they assimilate him. Or so, spoiler, or so you think. So here's the thing. Yeah, there's no time for games. And we got to, maybe we got to do something a little bit more on your face, a little more aggressive, a little bit more, you know, is it violent? Is it not violent? Who gets to say? But what Data did, because, again, they used a whole slew of different tactics to resist the Borg, right?
Mm-hmm.
Data was very much water. And he faked that they had hacked him. He acted and he went along with it in order to figure out how they operate so he could better resist. It was ingenious. It was sort of like, okay, he acted like they hacked into his system and that they got him to program and then they had him like in contact with now because he's a computer, you know, really sensitive information on their algorithms and how they approach stuff. And he was able to like, just like, yeah, I'm your buddy hanging out in there. You know, he was like a spy, you know, like, hey, we're friends and we're on the same team, although secretly I'm still working for the Enterprise, motherfucker. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, yes. But another part of the movie cut to James Cromwell, you know, who they had down there on Earth, who was making the first contact that went, you know, supposedly far and fast enough to get the attention of the Vulcans and all this. They were down there with missiles and bombs and all sorts of crazy state-of-the-art, you know, so like, all right, you know, they're doing it on that end.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? But everybody was coming together with their different approaches for the greater good of we have to resist the Borg by any means necessary.
And this is not unfounded to make this analogy here because like the Borg, our civilization will attempt to co-opt everything that exists and exploit it and extract every last drop of usefulness to the system. And it operates. It's a simulate or die, right? Play the game, or you're fucked.
Well, case in point. So something that's like I said, that's near and dear to me, the genetic modified organism movement. You know, earlier this summer, right, just as the nation was celebrating Vermont's first in the nation GMO labeling law going into effect July 1st, there was a handful of corporate owned organic companies, right, friends now in quotes, that sold out the GMO labeling movement to get a few small protections for their own corporate profits. Oh, God, Braveheart 2. God, we always talk about this. It's like, you know, the King of Scotland, like, fucking, here we go, I'll just abandon Wallace on the battlefield because I know I'm going to get some 30 pieces of silver. And at the time, Food Democracy Now! Gave a detailed analysis of exactly who was involved in this massive betrayal of the basic democratic rights and the will of the people, more than 90% of the American public. I think, like, it's that, and then it's universal background checks. Low 90%. And again, Americans don't agree on anything except for these two things. then in preceding months, the fallout has continued. Leading family farm and organic seed groups and top organic companies, they announced their resignation from the Organic Trade Association and Just Label It, which was, by the way, an action plan that I had said in previous shows that up until that time was actually part of the solution that then became co-opted. To your point, they had an active role in this outrageous betrayal of this GMO labeling, this whole thing with Debbie Stabenow, right? You know, this whole like QR codes and bullshit, this and whatever else. They did it. They sold it out. And now we don't have real labeling because a lot of the big players and heavy hitters, Stonyfield Yogurt, Whole Foods Markets, yes, yes, Iago. Yes, they all betrayed us. even the Organic Trade Association itself So this is why I say, like, Dr. Bronner's at the top of the show. You know, a great mom-and-pop company that does so much good and has been fighting for true labeling. They announced their resignation from the Organic Trade Association. And they said they're not going to, you know, betrayal of consumer-led GMO labeling movement. That was the number one reason that they left. And the truth is that as a movement, this is what David Bronner thinks, the CEO, we can't allow the outrageous betrayal of our movement to go unchallenged. The great news is that companies and nonprofit allies are standing up and exposing this outrageous sellout and demanding that small and mid-sized organic companies leave the OTA and protect organic standards. And his announcement comes on the heels of an announcement from the Oregon Consumers Association, a different group, that 60 leading nonprofits and small organic businesses are calling on the small and mid-sized organic companies to also now leave the Organic Trade Association.
Good.
Right? So this is a huge, big, shining example of how, great, we're all in this and we're fighting, and then, oh, the big heavy hitters that are supposed to be representing and leading us totally sell out to the bigger overlords and leave people and planet, you know, out to rot, out to hang. And then now you got this, like, fuck, man, how are we supposed to do it? You know, we did everything we're supposed to do. We got it on the ballot. You know, the people voted on it. The people want it. We got support. We've got grassroots, you know, endeavor across the country and this Just Label It movement and da-da-da-da-da, all this work. This is not something that a couple weeks, this has been going on for a few years. And then leave it to the people that said, we got this, we're driving this, we're going to take care of you, to go, and what do we get if we totally sell this whole thing out? Oh, we get that? Okay, we'll sell it out. So to your example, yes, I mean, that's a whole other thing that you have to fight. Your resistance is messy, especially when you're resisting now the former resistors.
Exactly.
It'd be like the Star Wars analogy. The equivalent would be like Luke and Han going in to battle, and then Han all of a sudden flipping the Millennium Falcon around to score off with Luke, Wedge, and the rest. I mean, now, that didn't happen because they're world-class resistors, and they're not going to sell each other out. That's why we like that movie, is because that didn't happen. Now, that did kind of happen with Lando, but Lando never really signed up to be part of the Rebel Alliance. And notice, afterwards, he grew a conscience, and he's like, fuck, I just want to be a gambler with Cloud City and make my money and be my ladies' man and do my thing. Shit. All right. I guess, you know what? If I don't take a stand now and resist this empire, at some point, this is really going to fucking come back to get me. And I need to also redeem myself to my friend that I just sold out to the Empire. So he had a whole different approach. Ultimately, he becomes a resistor and a general, mind you.
Hello, what have we here?
And well-deserved.
And well-deserved, yeah.
And this is a very common tactic, age-old, to co-opt the resistance. And so you must always resist that. So we talked about some individual things, but I came across this review of a book called Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, The Dynamics of People Power in the 20th Century by Peter Ackerman and Christopher Krugler. And one thing that they really focus on is that, A, that there's a little bit of a misconception that nonviolent means not aggressive or passive.
Right. That's not true. It could totally be aggressive. Yes. I'm glad.
Yes. Very aggressive. Yes. To, you know, like they talk about examples of messing with machinery and, you know, really fucking with shit.
Well, which, by the way, also, I mean, definitions really matter. I mean, some people might even say, well, that's violent.
Sure.
You're destroying property. That's a violent act. So, I mean, even that, it matters what we're talking about and who defines it and on what terms. Yes, yes.
Then the other thing that they really focus on is that it has to be strategic. And I think this is where a lot of people are lacking, and what we hope to be able to provide is the connective tissue for all of it, a place to be strategic and a method for being strategic and the means of being strategic. And that's what they've talked about, is violent or quote unquote nonviolent, the ones that succeed and the ones that don't. The common thread is there's a strategy to what's happening, instead of just a random act. I just like, I can't take it anymore. I'm just going to go and do this. You know, does it have the chance of working to a certain end? Of course it does. But if it's a longer term movement, then it has to have strategy. It has to have.
It's got to be focused, right? It's got to be like put towards something. I'm working towards something. You know, and I'm employing my talents and my vision toward this greater, larger form of resistance, whatever it is. So whatever I'm doing on a day-by-day basis, an hour-by-hour basis, a minute-by-minute, you break all that down. It's all going towards something bigger as opposed to, I'm just pissed and I'm just going to, you know, it gets lost. And to your point, maybe it does somehow randomly help out in some capacity, but it's more effective, it sounds like. Whether or not it's considered to be nonviolent or violent, whatever that means to whomever gets to decide what that means, mm-hmm. if it's focused, in theory, it has a greater capacity to do something, to disrupt the system, to get some pushback, you know, to say, hey, you know, this isn't working, and you know, we gotta find a way to make it, we gotta find a way to change it,
and that's why. That's why Derek Jensen is here.
So we're not the only ones that are here, right? And we're not. We've been talking our butts off, but like we've got this world-class resistor and awesome guest that is going to be joining us, not in studio, but via Skype. Thank goodness for technology on this particular day. I think it's high time that we meet him.
It's showtime, folks.
So we've got a very special guest today. He is the co-author of Deep Green Resistance and the author of Endgame, The Culture of Make-Believe, A Language Older Than Words, and many other books. He was named one of Utna Reader's 50 Visionaries Who Are Changing Your World and won the Eric Hoffer Award in 2008. He has written for Orion, Audubon, and The Sun Magazine, among many others. Let's give a warm, upside-downtrodden welcome to Derek Jensen. Derek, thank you for taking some time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So what is resistance and why is it important?
You know, as a sideline before we start, a lot of times interviews make me seem a lot smarter than I am because people ask me questions and I have this great answer that's just like this. And what they don't know is that that's because I've been asked the same question 300 times before.
Full disclosure. I like it.
So the point is, this is sort of an apologia because nobody has ever asked me before, what is resistance? So you're going to get my first answer, which is, God, that's a great question.
Thank you.
And
thank you very much.
Having stalled, I think I'm going to go backwards. I'm going to try to answer the question first, why is resistance important? And then after that, maybe that will help us both or all three of us understand what resistance is. And what the reason that resistance is necessary is because the planet's being killed. And there are stolid scientists who are saying that within 35 years, the oceans could be devoid of fish. And there are parts of China where that are so polluted that there are no pollinators, and that is the end of a relationship that has lasted for scores of millions of years. And this culture is dismantling every bit of the planet. And if that is not worth resisting, then there is literally nothing that is worth resisting. If you're not going to fight for life on this planet, then I don't know what it's worth fighting for. And there's that level. And then there's also we resist because it's the right thing to do. Because, I mean, I don't know about anybody else, and I can't speak for anybody else, but when I look back as I'm dying, I want to be able to look back and say, I did everything I could. You know, this is going to be really silly, but when I was in eighth grade, I was going to go out. I did go out for football, which was a dreadful mistake, but leave that aside. And a friend of mine who was in 10th grade, before the first day of practice, he gave me some older and wiser advice, which is try as hard as you can, no matter how tired you get, because at the end of the season, you don't want to look back and say, I could have tried harder. I know that that's just corny on one level, but it's really true. It's one of the reasons I've become a writer is because I didn't want to look back at the end of my life and say, wow, whose life was this? I could have lived the life I really should have been living. And it's the same with resistance, that I don't want to look back and say, if only I could have tried a little bit harder, I might have been able to help in this way. And now, so far as what resistance is, I think for me, it's really hard to define because, I mean, there's sort of the physics level where resistance is, you know, air resistance slows things down. You have a bullet flying through the air that goes slower and slower because of air resistance. Friction is one of the ways to describe it sort of in physics terms, that it is the, you know, you have some, you're pushing a chair across the floor and the chair will not move because of resistance from the floor. And so there's that level. But I want to expand it beyond that because, you know, especially after having written Endgame, I got pegged as the violence guy because I believe that sometimes it's appropriate to fight back. And that is an important part of resistance that I don't want to downplay. But at the same time, I really feel like I'm the everything guy because I believe that there is, okay, I'm going to stop and go another direction. Even when you talk about the military, only a very small percentage, like 5 or 10% of soldiers ever fire their weapon at an enemy. And in the IRA, only 2% of the people in the IRA ever picked up weapons. My point being that it's like Napoleon said, that an army marches on its stomach. And so are the people who are shooting guns, let's forget the fact that Napoleon was conquering everybody for a second, but are the people who are shooting guns, are they the only ones who are actually considered to be fighting? What about the cooks? What about the medics? What about, you know, Rommel was very big on quartermasters are the ones who really win battles. And, you know, if you don't have, in terms of a modern military, if you don't have gasoline, you're out, mm-hmm. you lose. And so when I think about resistance, I think not only about, I was just having a conversation with somebody about this a couple of days ago that it was a woman who was saying that she wishes her health would allow her to go to up to the Dakotas to help with the stopping the pipeline up there, but she can't. And so what she's done, she lives in California, and what she's done is she has helped organize some care packages to go up there. And I was saying to her that I think that that is in its own way just as important, because you can have thousands of people up there actively resisting, and what are they going to eat? And we can valorize, oh, yes, let's go stand on the front lines, and that's great. But once again, those people have to be fed, and those people have to – you know, I have been friends with some tree sitters, and the best tree sitters, the ones that were liked the most by their ground crews – they were very explicit that they couldn't have been doing it if somebody weren't carrying their shit bucket every day. And so there's a sense in which carrying the shit bucket is a part of that resistance and just as important as the person sitting in the tree. So what is resistance? I think that resistance is being in that front line with resistance. Resistance is also, you know, Milan Kundera said that the struggle against depression is the struggle of memory against forgetting. And so I think the people who help us remember, that is a part of resistance. And the people who recruit for the frontline resistance are a part of the resistance. And the people who do support work, you know, what resistance movements need is loyalty and material support. And the people who provide the material support are part of it. The people who provide the loyalty are part of it. And so what is resistance? I think resistance includes people who are – I think there's a sense – see, the thing is, what's important to me is the question, whom is your – whom are your actions helping? And so I think that there is a sense in which helping to rehabilitate a stream would be a form of resistance, because the question to me is – where is your loyalty and who's being helped? So it's a really important thing to try to stop a timber sale that cuts down trees. It's also a really important thing to attempt to rehabilitate after a clear cut if it's happened. And it's a really important thing to educate people about what clear cuts do, et cetera, et cetera. Is this making any sense at all?
Absolutely.
It's making a ton of sense. And I really appreciate the all hands on deck, everybody's important, because I think that that brings people together, and building a coalition is also something that's going to help resistance be more successful. So we sort of believe that every person knows to varying degrees deep down that something is wrong with this civilization, and it would appear that the problems are in pinpointing the causes of their suffering and fostering the willingness to resist in the first place. So sort of our question is, how do we make the problems of civilization visible to the masses? And we know a lot of the ways, but we'd like to get your take on it. And if the problems of civilization are visible to the masses and it's more of an issue of denial or apathy, how do we move the masses out of denial and or apathy and into action?
Well, before I answer that, I want to comment on your phrase, all hands on deck, and go back to that. And of course, that's a military term. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what we think about. It's like, you know, all hands on deck is everybody needs to get to battle stations. And that, once again, includes not just the people actually firing the anti-aircraft guns, but that includes the people who are carrying stuff around, the medics, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just saying that all hands on deck just really works perfectly for this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sean and I have used the analogy too of a castle under siege. And so Sean and I are very different personalities. I'm more of the swordsman out front on the outside of the castle wall that's doing what he can do in that respect. Sean's kind of like on top of the castle wall as an archer doing what he can do. And then I think about my mom, who's more of a lay helper behind the castle, tending to the sick and the wounded and what have you. And I'm like, there's just no way any of us could do any of what we're doing if we're not all doing it. So again, to your point, it's sort of the same thing, but a different way of saying that, like, in order to have an opportunity to resist, you know, this invasion or this attack in this metaphor, I couldn't do it, Sean couldn't do it, and my mom couldn't do it. We kind of need all three and more, but just sort of an example, three different, you know, strengths and three different focuses, but they're all equally important, I'm assuming.
Right. And yes, exactly. And so far as the question about how can we get the mass of people to recognize the difficulties and to act, it's really, I think it's the same with that there are a bunch of different approaches. And one of the things I think about is the way I sign. When I sign copies of Endgame Volume 1, I always sign them, find what you love and defend your beloved, because no matter what you love, it's under assault. And so I think it's really important for people to find the things that are important to them and to then attempt to resist against the assaults on those. And one example is I have a good friend who used to run a battered women's program for the state of New York. And what's really important to her is she's extraordinary. She asks every man she sees, what will it take for men to stop beating on women? And I mean, seriously, you get in a taxi with her, she'll say, can you take us to Central Park? And by the way, what's going to take for men to stop beating on women? It's like, do not ever get in the subway with this woman. She's fabulous. And I would never say to her, gosh, what you need to do is help protect salmon, because that's not her thing. That's not what she loves. She doesn't dislike salmon, but she's got her thing that really brings her passion. Or another way to say all this is that there's a guy who used to run a computer store here in town, a little independent computer repair place. And I would never, if I were going to talk about politics with him, I would never talk about salmon because he didn't care. What I would talk about is the fact that Walmart was driving him out of business. And I would talk about what big box stores do to small businesses. And so, which it actually is what happened. He ended up getting driven out of Walmart, driven out of business, and ended up having to get a job at the prison, which is like, there's a metaphor for you. Anyway, so it's one of the things is to find, I'll tell you another story about this. I really hate it when I'm doing a talk and teachers have required attendance for their students. And the reason I hate that is because the students don't want to be there. If the students want to be at my talk, we have a great time. You know, everybody, we talk about issues they care about. It's fun. It's jokes. It's heartbreaking, all this stuff. But if they're there because of required attendance, they are there the same way that I would have been, and presumably you would have been too in college. It's like you're sitting there, okay, another 30 minutes till I get to go. So I'm doing a talk about the murder of the planet. Nobody cares. They're all texting. They're all sitting there. Their eyes are completely glazed. I'm thinking, okay, this is completely not working. So instead, I started talking about the fact that I used to have this habit of asking people if they like their jobs, and about 90% say no. And what does it mean when the vast majority of people spend the vast majority of their waking hours doing things they don't want to do? And what does it mean when you have people who are in college who – and this was when I was in college too. My fellow students were doing this. You have people in college looking forward to the day they retire. And I started talking about that, and all these students who had been bored out of their minds 5 seconds earlier are like, huh? Huh? And all of a sudden – so my point is – one of the things that I think is tactically really helpful is to find the places where people are already upset, and then use those places as wedges. Use those places to start dropping in seeds that can eventually, one hopes, grow into a more systematic analysis of the problem to help them start by – because here's the thing. There's an environmentalist once said to me, my environmental mentor, John Osborne, he said to me, a lot of environmentalists begin by wanting to protect a specific piece of ground, and they end up questioning the foundations of Western civilization. And the reason is because once the questions start, they don't stop. And so you can start by asking, why are they going to destroy this particular piece of ground? Answer is, well, for economic reasons. Question then becomes, why would you have, and what does it mean when you have an economic system that's based on destroying the land? And then once you ask that question, it leads to the question of what have been the historical results of this, and they just keep going. And it's the same with others. If you can get somebody to ask, what does it mean when you have the vast majority of people working jobs they don't want to do, who is benefiting from this system? We have a system that is sort of on autopilot. There's a great line by Frederick Winslow Taylor, the guy who Taylorization, the rationalization of the workplace, where he's the guy who came up with, okay, so like what you do at McDonald's is you have it so every worker rationalizes their process, by which is meant they get rid of every extraneous motion. So they flip a burger, and then they flip a burger, and they just do the same thing. And he had this great line about, in the past, the man was first, in the future, the system shall be first. And so if you can like get people on, oh, you don't like your job? Oh, you don't like the fact that you have to actually pay money in order to live on this planet? It's like, okay, so where does that come from? And then just sort of prod on. And that's one of the ways that I do, at least, is to try to help people to start recognizing these, is to find the places they're upset, and then to try to channel that upset or help them begin to articulate the real sources of their misery. Because it's really easy. I mean, Donald Trump is an example of this, and I am no Democrat fan either. But culture make-believe, and culture make-believe, something I'm pretty proud of, is I talked in there about the rise of the KKK and how oftentimes when the middle class gets hammered, oftentimes what happens is a period of reactionary xenophobia, and women get assaulted more when the mill closes, and people of color are hated more when the mill closes, when there's economic difficulty. So we can predict, with the collapse of the middle class, we can really predict Trump. So what's really helpful, I think, is to try to help people to see that the source of their misery is not the African Americans, if you're a white person. The source of your misery is not
gays or women or
gays or women or whomever
or Muslims, right? Yeah,
or white people,
or white the source. Or white people individually,
right?
The problem can be the larger whiteness of white supremacy and the system that and capitalism that sets all these different groups against each other. So that's something we can do too, and which you're obviously doing, is to attempt to help people to see the real sources of their misery. You see the same thing in abusive families, by the way, where everybody can be at each other's throats, and what's happening is the abuser is the one who's benefiting from all this. One of the reasons this is really important is because systematically there's this phrase called identifying with the oppressor, and it happens in families and abusive families. It happens on a larger scale too, that we are trained very early on to make our allegiance to the actual perpetrator. And so one of the things that we need to do is we need to break it. I mean, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, for God's sake.
Well, Sean and I actually, even before Colin Kaepernick brought that to the fore, we've for years – I won't stand when there's a pledge of allegiance. I won't stand at the national anthem.
No hand over heart. It's just no hand over heart,
nothing. Anachronistic ridiculous thing. Yeah, totally. And by the way, nobody's asked me about it, but if they want to, I'd be more than happy to engage in a conversation about it, because I have strong reasons why, as does Sean. But yes, but you're exactly right. So it is reinforced at an early age to identify with the system that is exploiting us, that is abusing us, that is also destroying the planet as we know it. So the efforts by the Great Sioux Nation to resist the pipeline. They've proven, if we're talking about resistance, and I know how you break it down with an overarching strategy underneath which you have different operations, and underneath that, then you have different tactics that you employ to achieve an operation to try to push toward your overarching strategy. If we're looking at this Dakota Access Pipeline resistance movement, how has it proven to be effective thus far to the point that many people are now aware of the fight and have moved into action to support the operation? Is this an example of one of civilization's many problems becoming visible, and an example of one of civilization's many problems becoming visible and people knowing about it and having what they perceive as clear steps to take to work towards solving it? You know what I mean? And if so, does that why doesn't that happen for more of civilization's problems? You know, what's special about the Dakota Access Pipeline that even the capitalist press, to coin your phrase, is having to report it, albeit skewed, but report it nonetheless? I think that they would rather just ignore it and pretend it's not happening and not give it any press, any attention at all, because they want to keep it in the dark and suppress it. But it's out there. It is part of the national, at least, and in some respects, international conversation and zeitgeist at the moment. Which is, and I think it's fantastic. I mean, again, all hands on deck, any means possible. Let's talk about it. Let's get people. But the question is, what is it about that? I mean, there's thousands, you know, and how come they don't inspire people to act or get people engaged? You know, like, is there something special in the soup with this one? Was it chosen for some reason that I'm not seeing?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, and I don't know how something ends up becoming a flashpoint, because there are multiple other pipelines going in, you know, as we speak.
Exactly.
And those – well, we should all mark this on the calendar, because you're going to get an answer here that does not happen very often, which is you're going to hear a white male say, "I don't know."
But you know, mark it down.
Yeah. I honestly don't know. I don't know. We could make stuff up, which right. Of course white males are especially good at doing. We could make stuff up as to why this one gets more attention than others. But I don't know, and I also don't know whether this will be some sort of turning point for resistance, or whether this will 2 years from now be not remembered. I don't. As another friend of mine always says, the crystal ball is always cloudy, and I don't.
Yeah, I thought I'd ask, because what I'm thinking about is, if there is something, you know, special about it, like, what is that? How do we harness that? How do we use that? How do I pull out of that, you know, the special recipe, if there is one, and then put that into the mix? So, okay, I'll hit people where they're soft, or where they're vulnerable, or where they're impressionable, and I'll also employ this tactic that, you know, is getting the type of press you want and getting the type of response you want.
Well, I think I love the phrase by Brock Evans about the way to make political change is endless pressure, endlessly applied. And so I think, and for me at least, and this is something that the capitalists are really, really good at, is they keep pushing. And then if you stop them, they keep pushing. And then if you stop them again, they keep pushing in a different direction. And I mean, you know, anybody who's ever opposed, say, some sort of subdivision going in, you stop them, and then they come back again next year, and you got to stop them again. And they keep doing this until one year, you know, you happen to be sick, and the other people in the neighborhood are on vacation, and something else happens, they get it through. And we need to do the same thing. We need to keep applying the pressure and meanwhile building up public support and changing the nature of the discussion, a public discussion about it. And that's really, really difficult for us because they control the media, they control the political system, they control the schooling system, they control everything. The advantage we have is we have the truth. And lies are very expensive to propagate. But nonetheless,
they also have all the money.
Yeah, they do. And and going back to getting the masses on our side, it's really difficult for a couple reasons. One is that I love the line by Upton Sinclair, it's hard to make a man understand something when his job depends on him not understanding it. And we in the global elite are receiving tangible benefits for this way of life. My point is that Lewis Mumford talked about why is it that so many of us have surrendered our autonomy to this wretched system, and it's because of what he calls the magnificent bribe, that basically because the system provides for us, he doesn't say this, but basically because it provides for us ice cream 24/7, because it provides for us all these goodies, then we have surrendered. And I think that that is in great measure true, and it also has made many of us very, very stupid. Because we can't see, many of us, that you can't have infinite growth on a finite planet.
Oh, yeah.
All right, finally, our polling question that we ask all our guests before we go. And again, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule. We sure appreciate it. We know a listener does as well. Are we going to make it as a species?
How long?
I think we would just say at all.
The way things are going, I don't think humans will last another 100 years. Some people think it's sooner. I don't think humans will last. And that's not really, honestly, that's not the important question to me. The important question to me is, will the oceans last? And will the salmon last? And will the tree frogs last?
All right. Will they?
The way things are going, no. If I give salmon another 15 years, and if civilization hasn't crashed in 15 years, salmon are gone. And if it has crashed, here's the good news. I do have one piece of good news.
Share it, please.
There are 450 pieces. There are 450 dead zones in the ocean, or more than 450 dead zones in the ocean. One of them has recovered. The one that recovered is in the Black Sea, and it recovered because with the collapse of the Soviet Union, it made industrial agriculture no longer economically feasible along the shores. And so with that primary problem removed, the ocean recovered. And so here's the thing, is that what I see environmentalists, not the environmental, the conservation industrial complex, but real environmentalists, what I see us doing, it's like we're in a emergency room and there's a patient been brought in, the patient's bleeding all over, and we are putting on Band-Aids as fast as we can. We're trying to sew everything up. It's all doing incredibly important work, except the killer is still standing there stabbing the patient on the gurney. And so what we need to do is we need to stop the stabbing. That's what resistance is. Well, some people need to cover up the bandages. Some people need to do all that. Other people need to stop this motherfucker.
Great, great way to end right there. Derek, thank you so much. I think it's been very enlightening for us and will be very enlightening for our listeners. And thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks. And let's do it again sometime.
Will do. Thanks, Derek. Take care. Hey, give our best to Heather, will you?
I will do that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Well, that was amazing and incredibly helpful, and I guess, yeah, it's an understatement to say this is complex. This really is very complex. Resistance, learning how to resist, what that means, how to measure it, knowing that we're in this plight and that the only answer is going to be us, and how are we going to figure it out? Otherwise, we're fucking dead.
Yes, and who better? I just love the way he, first of all, is so approachable. Second of all, no one knows more what the problem is
than Derek Jensen. So what a great resource for us to have and for our listeners to have.
And we're going
to
bring him back. We're definitely bringing him back. Fantastic.
I hope so.
And that's not a slight against any other guest. You're all welcome. You've all been great guests and future guests too. So Sean, what are we going to do about it? How are we going to resist by any means necessary to move beyond civilization?
We always like to suggest a little light reading or heavy reading as it may be necessary. So first for me is read Ackerman and Krugler's Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, The Dynamics of People Power in the 20th Century. Two, read Derek Jensen's books, as many as you can find time to read. He's done more to inform us of the nature of the problems of civilization than anyone since Rousseau. High praise. We just said it. Take a shot.
Well deserved.
Should be good enough for you, listener. Three, listen to Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up. Then get out there and do just that. Get up and stand up by any means necessary. Thanks, Derek. Four, don't wait till it's too late to do something. You may not be feeling directly the problems of civilization, but they are coming your way whether you like it or not, whether you admit it or not, whether it's convenient or not. And if you don't do this, then all is truly lost.
Support resistance movements, okay? So you could start with Standing Rock, for instance. So you can go to standingrock.org. We talked about them a lot on the show, and you can find out how you can become involved, or you can just start a resistance movement. Start small and do one very simple, very small act of resistance today. What do you mean, Scott? Qualify that. Okay. When you're walking down, let's say, the street and you see a piece of trash on the street, pick it up and put it in a waste basket somewhere. I mean, like, but that doesn't really help.
Yeah, it does.
It's the intention behind it. How about a win? I mean, all this resistance making me feel down, man, but we should also be feeling pretty good about some stuff, right? This is what happens when you resist, right?
Thankfully.
This summer, Obama created the largest protected place on the planet in Hawaii. It's the largest ecologically protected area on the planet. He expanded a national marine monument in his native Hawaii to encompass more than 500,000 square miles. He more than quadrupled the size of, and say this right, Papahanaumokuanakeha.
You did well.
Marine National Monument. To now almost 600,000 square miles of land and sea in the northwestern Hawaiian Islands. Well, what do you know? That's the show.
I wish we had 3 hours for this one.
Well, we may have to do it again. We may have to do it again. This is a topic that, like so many, deserve maybe a couple more shows.
Well, the show may be over, but the effort has just begun. So stick with us, listeners.
And I don't think this was our worst show.
I put in here perhaps our most important to date, but now I know for sure. Our most important show to date.
No pressure. Remember the Holy Trinity. Think critically, feel deeply, ask questions. For what purpose, to what end, and at what cost? It might just save your life. And in honor of National Regifting Day, we'll be asking those very questions during our next show when we discuss conservation. Not the conservation industrial complex. Conservation. And remember, resistance is fertile, Borgs.
Before we go, here are some words to live by.
Resistance means refusal. Resist. Peace.
For Sean Amony, this is Scott Mullen saying, when life gets you down, always remember to look at the upside down triangle.
Thank you, and you're welcome.